So I'm going to ask you if you would stand with me to just read our passage, and then we'll pray. It's not a big passage, but there's plenty here. Starting in verse 19 of Luke chapter 20, we read this. The scribes and the chief priests tried to lay hands on him that very hour, and they feared the people, for they understood that he spoke this parable against them. So they watched him and sent spies who pretended to be righteous in order that they might catch him in some statement so that they could deliver him to the rule and authority of the governor. They questioned him, saying, "Teacher, we know that you speak and teach correctly, and you are not partial to any, but teach the way of God in truth. Is it lawful for us to pay taxes to Caesar or not?" But he detected their trickery and said to them, "Show me a denarius. Whose likeness and inscription does it have?" They said, "Caesar's." And he said to them, "Then render to Caesar the things which are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's." And they were unable to catch him in a saying in the presence of the people, and being amazed at his answer, they became silent. So as we get ready to look at this small section, and very familiar, I think, with a lot of people, one thing I do want to say is, we never want to lose sight of the big picture. The Gospels are telling a story. The story is God in the flesh came incarnate to this world. And Jesus Christ, being fully man and fully God, set on a path. And on this path that he set upon is to follow the will of God, to obey God's will. And part of that will is, ultimately, to go to the cross, to be the sacrifice. Just like the Passover lamb, only this sacrifice, Jesus himself, would be the ultimate sacrifice because he would be raised from the dead. And his sacrifice would continue to forgive sins, past, present, and future. And because of the sacrifice, he could accomplish a couple of different things. But one of them was individually to offer us forgiveness of sins by coming to faith in Jesus Christ alone and what he has done. But the second thing he was going to do was he's going to take two groups of people, as Ephesians talks about, hostile towards each other, Jews and Gentiles, and bring them together through Christ and in covenant into one another, and somehow fulfill covenants from the Old Testament, like the Abrahamic covenant, Davidic covenant. All of this in this big meta-narrative. And so, number one, the reason I always want to share that is because I never know if somebody walks in here, they do not know Jesus. And if you don't know Jesus, the most important message I can tell you is all of us are going to stand before God. And we're going to have to give an account for sins. And the thing is, we cannot be good enough to do anything about our sins. In fact, we can't cover our sins by being better. But one did cover our sins, and that is Jesus Christ. And I would beg you, if you have not done this, put your faith, your trust in Jesus Christ alone. After that, I don't want to say it's gravy, but now we're in a different realm. We are talking about now what's it like to have a relationship with Jesus. But that's where you got to start. So now in this account that we're reading, small account within, he's, and understand, we're like in Jerusalem and he's days away from dying. And things have been turned up. And so he has this encounter, and we're told that this encounter came out of the previous parable. Now, just to refresh your memory, I call it the previous parable, the parable of trouble for some. Now, if you weren't with us, a couple weeks ago we had talked about the parable. The parable was a cause for anger among the leadership of Israel, because if you remember, it was about a vine, about the vineyard owner, and there were tenant farmers, or we call them sometimes vine tenderers, or depending on how your translation has it. But we know the vine owner is God, the religious leaders are the tenant farmers, if you will. And of course, the son whom is killed is none other than Jesus himself. Now, it's funny because instead of understanding the gist of what this was teaching, all they knew, that is the religious leaders, these scribes, these chief priests, oh, this is an indictment against us. We don't like that. We kind of wanted to kill Jesus anyway. Now we really want to kill Jesus. But they also understand, and we're told in verse 19, and I think when we went through this before, we finished at 19, but 19 is that transitional verse. Because it really sets up, what's this next encounter going to be? And the next encounter is, we can't do this out in front of everybody because we're fearful of what they're going to do to us. Now, I always say this because I think the Bible is very clear. If you fear God, you should not have to fear people. And yet, here's the religious leaders who were supposedly supposed to be teaching the people how to fear God are afraid of people. I mean, deep down, I think they know why. Why? Because they're really not fearing God. But here we have, this sets us up then for what I call sinning in the snakes. Now, I can make a good reason for this little title for these two verses. Because this word for cunning or trickery makes us think about the great serpent of old, Satan himself. But if we look at verses 20 and 21 as a whole as we read them, we notice, first of all, we're told in verse 20 that the leadership is watching Jesus closely. Not a surprise. They're looking for opportunities. How can we get Jesus? And when it says they're looking him, watching closely, they're specifically finding ways they can catch him. And specifically, it's telling us finding ways to catch him so they could hand him over to the rule and authority of the government. Now, why would they want to do it that way? Well, I think the reason they want to do it that way is because it's a whole lot easier. So if you say, oh, well, the Roman government, they're the ones who are in charge, we can get two birds killed with one stone because we can say, oh, we couldn't do anything. It was the Roman government. So that people were upset about Jesus getting seized and killed, well, we didn't have anything to do with it. But on the other hand, they get exactly what they want. They want Jesus gone. It's interesting because to do this, though, they're sending spies to infiltrate the crowds to find words that Jesus speaks to incriminate him. In fact, not just to find it, they're going to instigate it, right? Bob Deffenbaugh makes a great observation here. He says, you know, the solution to their problem, these religious leaders, as the Jewish leaders reason, was a political one, not a spiritual one. They did not seek to deal with Jesus in a way prescribed by the Old Testament law. Isn't that funny? The experts in the law are not looking for ways to deal with Jesus through the law. No, what are they doing? They did not, as did the psalmist of old, turn Jesus over to God for divine discipline. They turn instead to a secular government. The irony is Jesus is going to address this because of how they ask the question. Which, this is where it really does apply to us, because there are things that Jesus says that I think are very fascinating for us to consider about how we deal with God, how we deal with government, and those kinds of things. So what we're not told here as we look, but we are told in the Gospel of Mark, is that the Sanhedrin find themselves members of the Pharisees and Herodians to sin. So if you look at the Gospel of Mark, this account, it tells us they found both Pharisees and Herodians. Now, these two don't typically get paired up together. But they're going to work together for this task. Now, why? Why these two? Well, Pharisees, we know. Pharisees, they're separating. Separating from all things they consider impure. And that would be on the basis of the Mosaic law, but not just the law. They're going to the oral interpretation of the law, which is an additional set of laws. Separation. Now, do you think the Pharisees loved the Roman government? Of course not. But here you have working together with who? Herodians. Well, who are Herodians? They're sympathizers and supporters of Herod and the Herodian dynasty. Now, they've got a different set of motivations. It might be like the Pharisees and the, dare I say, the Republican Party, or the Pharisees and the Democratic Party. for the Pharisees and the Libertarian Party, working together for the same goal. How odd is that? It ought to tell you how bad Jesus was hated by these people. And not just by these groups of people. We mentioned the Sadducees. There were a number of them that wanted to take him out. Now, if I'm going to look at this in the big scheme of things, I go to Genesis 3. Who's the instigator in Genesis 3? It's really Satan himself. It's really those that have rebelled against God from the beginning have set in place a plan to oppose God in every step of the way. It's all the way through the book of Revelation. So this is not a surprise that somehow you would see odd fellows together, groups of people for one purpose. But you know, these Pharisees, at least you would think, you know the law. Supposedly you're basing this lifestyle on the law. Don't you think you would pick up on things that are inconsistent, you know? But what they fail to see in themselves is their own religious hypocrisy. Well, why do I say that? Because if you look very closely, they sent spies who pretended to be righteous. This idea, by the way, pretending, and the word spy is not in there. You know what the word is? It's the Greek word for hypocrite. They're going to go to where Jesus is teaching in the temple, putting on the face, hypocrites, of being righteous when they have ulterior motives. That sounds kind of odd, right? But in order to the men of the crowd, you know, they want to get in there, they want to appear that they're on board with what Jesus is doing. Yes, we are on board, and so we're not surprised when they approach Jesus and ask a question that they're going to say things that are extremely complimentary. They want to portray that they are followers of Jesus and that they are bought into his teaching, which is far from the case. They actually hate Jesus. That's why they're there. And if you'll notice, as they come to talk to Jesus, to question him, they lay it on thick. They say words about him they don't believe. So, for example, you know, when they're talking about, we know that you speak and teach correctly, you're not partial to any, you teach the way of God and truth. These are all words really kind of designed to give flattery, to make it appear we're all on board with what you're teaching. And also to kind of prime the pump. Flattery of their words is done to get an answer out of Jesus. And they just want to make him, quote, I guess, feel comfortable. And so things like this phrase, you are not partial to any, it emphasizes truth is going to be taught. You're not going to be influenced by anyone, not subject to one's whims. So they want to encourage that. They're highlighting that. You teach the way of God is different than the Greek notion of the truth of God. Well, what's different? Well, the way of God is focusing on not merely right thinking, but right behavior, really an orientation of life. In fact, in some cases, you think of the early church was called the way. It's not just about knowing the truth. It's about a whole orientation of life. The word, by the way, the word for way is also the word for road. Did you know that? Just a little tidbit there. But what are they really? They're hypocrites. None of this is true. And, you know, it's a good thing that religious hypocrisy died after Christ was risen from the dead, right? So we don't have to deal with that anymore, do we? That's right, Amal. No more hypocrisy. No. Religious hypocrisy is a danger for all. So if you look at what they're doing and really say, what's the root of it? The root of religious hypocrisy is the need to make things different or appear to be different than they really are in one's life. So you're trying to put yourself on to be something you're not. Now, here's a question as I think about religious hypocrisy, and you think about it as well. Talk about this group. So this group, they're spies, if you will, for lack of a better way to put it. That's what they're there for. They're there for a purpose, not because they're following, not because they want to be taught, simply to hear and to report back. Specifically, things that we can go to, for example, the Roman government and say, hey, here's the problem. But what does that got to do with us when we talk about religious hypocrisy? Well, if we think about if we're believers, we're Christians, okay? We understand that the reason we became a Christian was not because of what we did. In fact, it's an acknowledgement and a recognition and a conviction we are sinners that cannot please God. And so that is the basis of being a Christian. You come to the point of yourself, the end of yourself, and the need for Jesus, right? So here's the problem. We become religious hypocrites as Christians when we want to project to be someone that we're not, if you will, to gain the affirmation of typically other believers. And, you know, as I was kind of wrestling with this a little bit and listening to some people wrestle with it as well and talk about it, you know, so you would say, oh, just tell everyone how terrible I am and, tell all my faults. Is that what you mean? So I'm not a hypocrite? What do we mean? It's not to walk around telling every sinful thought, deed, motivation to everyone within earshot. That's not what I'm saying. But to avoid being a hypocrite, this is the thing. It's the idea of projecting, putting something on that's not really true, to make ourselves look better to others than we know we really are. So specifically, I mean, I've written some things down, but specifically, here's what I think about is, you know, I've got friends who we go way back. Friends that have gotten into ministry. And with some of my friends, and I'll just pick on my friend Kelly who's sitting back there, but when I call him, Kelly is going to tell me how things are really going. He's not going to pretend, oh, I'm just going great, everything's going great. Sometimes it might be, I put my foot in my mouth with Sandy again. Can't believe I said that. But then I've got other friends that I've known just as long as Kelly in ministry who literally, if I were to talk to them, I would think they've got the best marriage in the world. I'm just like, my marriage doesn't look like that. What's going on? And you just wonder, I mean, I'm not trying to pick fun of this, but you know, you guys know when Promise Keepers first came out, you know, they had bumper stickers, and one of them was, I think, Promise Keepers, I love, I heart my wife. That means love for you, the younger generation. That doesn't ring a bell. So, we had a particular guy in our spiritual formation class, and I saw that. And I saw the bumper stickers and everything. And a lot of us, his wife hadn't come yet to seminary. So I thought, my goodness, I can't wait to meet this gal. I mean, their marriage must be incredible. Wow, I bet. I love, his name's Pat, not a Pat that lives in Nebraska, somewhere else. I love Pat, but their marriage is far from this bumper sticker, I love my wife. In fact, it was just like talking with this his wife when she did finally, you know, move the second semester. I was like, wow. It's like two opposites. I don't think Pat was trying to, you know, portray something. But what happens is if you do that, you're portraying something that's not true. God is not telling you, oh, you get saved, you got perfection. And I think our real problem is the reason why we don't have people praying for us for our weaknesses because we're so worried about putting across, this is how we are. You can say, I really want to be this kind of person, but I'm not there. That's different than projecting something you're not. Because I'm going to tell you what, you can talk about how great a marriage is and everything else, but you'll tell you what, spend an evening with a couple and you'll know how. And you don't have to say anything. You can tell how they jive and everything else together. And here's my point. My point is that how do we deal with being a hypocrite? First of all, don't portray yourself to be someone you're not. I mean, we're a work in progress. Have you figured that out yet? I mean, Jim, I hate to tell you, you're a work in progress. Like I am, right? God's not done with me. I'm thankful for that. I got a lot to clean up. But here's the thing. I'm thankful for that because He's continuing to work in areas of my life that need to be worked in. So we're not celebrating where we fail. What we are saying is we're not going to try to tell you we're perfect and that we have it all figured out. And in fact, one thing I think that's helpful is how do you avoid hypocrisy? First Thessalonians, this verse came in this discussion of this. First Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 4. You can look it up or you can listen to me. I'll give you a second if you want to look it up. 1 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 4. I'm just looking it up to make sure I didn't misprint that. So as Paul is exhorting the Thessalonians, he says, "But just as we have been approved by God to be entrusted with the gospel, so we speak." Here's the key, not as pleasing men, but God who examines our hearts. Do things to please Him. If you're worried about impressing God, and you know why? If you want to impress God, God already knows your stuff. So you're not going to fool Him. So if you stop worrying about doing that and focus on pleasing Him, you're going to go a lot further in really what you want to accomplish in your life, spiritually speaking. And that's the whole thing. This is where I see the contrast between men that are sinning for the sake of their precious worship system with God, and they're sinning pretending to be righteous. Do you realize how horrible? And the word in Greek is hypocritical. That's what they are. So what do we learn from that? We learn, you know, there's never a place for that within worship. So then the next thing is the question is going to come out, right? In verse 22, and it's going to be about really the government. But this is the gotcha question. Have you ever been asked a gotcha question? Like somebody said, like, "Scott, have you stopped being mean to your wife?" So what is that? You can't win with that question, can you, if you answer it? If you say yes, oh, see, he was mean. No, oh, Scott, you're still being mean. It's a gotcha question. This is what they try to do. So when look at verse 22. Is it lawful for us to pay taxes to Caesar or not? So let's talk about this question because this is important. So the nature of the question on its face value is about a tax. Luke, when it uses the word for tax, it uses a more general word, phoron, which could apply to any kind of tribute or tax. Mark, the Gospel of Mark, uses a different word. It uses kainson, which is a loan word from Latin, and probably is restricted in the sense of what's called a head tax. Well, what's a head tax? A head tax involved a periodic census, most likely one denarius, that is a day's wage, for adults, males, ages 14 to 65 years old. So if you think about what the question is asking, it's stated in a manner that questions really the ethics of giving a tax to Caesar. And the key is with the phrase, is it lawful? Now, if we think is it lawful, think law. So think, is this congruent with the Mosaic law to give this money to Caesar and this tax? And so this question deals with the law of God. What does God consider fitting or lawful in regards to this tax to the government? So that's why you would say, does this deal with God and the government? Yeah, it does. It sure does. But for those of us who do not like taxes, raise your hand if you don't like taxes. Well, I mean, if you do, you can pay my taxes if you're not raising your hand. I'll let you pay them for me. I joke, I kid. This is not a question of taxes in general, though. You know why? You ever heard of it? What was called in the Old Testament the temple tax? That was a tax. There were other taxes in Israel that had nothing to do with the Roman government. John Nolan talks about the origins of this particular tax, temple tax, and it came from the basis of the precedent of Nehemiah 10:32-33, where the people committed themselves to an annual temple tax of one-third of a shekel. And the stipulation in Exodus, a custom had arisen, was being defended in Jesus' day as a requirement of law of levying an annual temple tax on males over 20 to finance offerings in the temple made on behalf of the whole people. And you would say, well, how would they do that? Well, you know what? Would they just wait till they get to the temple? Because you had a people that lived further out. Wouldn't that just discourage them from coming in? No, they were resourceful. William Barclay comments that the method of collection was carefully organized. On the first of the month, Adar, which is March of our year, announcement was made in all towns and villages of Palestine that the time to pay the tax had come. On 15th Adar, booths were set up in each town and village, and at the booths, the tax was paid. If the tax was not paid by the 25th of that month, it could only be paid directly to the temple in Jerusalem. By the way, the tax was more than this head tax, because it was 2 days' wages. What did we say a denarius was equivalent to? 1 day. So this is not an issue of taxes. I wish it was. Although it's not going to work for being a conscientious objector to taxes. Government's not going to let you get out of paying that. Sorry. But what is the issue? The issue is with paying the Roman tax. And why the Roman tax? Because it has to do with an occupation of Israel's land. Now, if I go back and I look through 1 Kings, 2 Kings, and we look at some of the things that were going on, even really back into Genesis, one of the things that a nation goes and they occupy another nation. So we go back to Abraham and Lot, and we understand some of the things going on and with the history behind it. We knew that at one point in time that the nations coming in would want, they call it a tribute, but it's a tax. And so what do you do when you rebel? You don't pay the tribute, you don't pay the tax, and then that causes the army to be sent, and people die, and then they're going to have to pay the money, and it's going to be taken out. So this is really about this occupation of Israel's land in light of the Abrahamic covenant. Should we be paying the tax? Is it lawful? Now, this is maybe an appropriate, on its face value, you might say, appropriate. Sure, F.F. Bruce says, you know, the appropriateness of these foreign levies would be a perennial area of questioning, meaning this probably came up quite a bit. Why? Because extremely burdensome levels of taxation. Secondly, a natural antipathy to foreign domination. That's a big one. And number three, an understandable conviction that as God's people, their proper natural state was a free nation subject to God alone. So this is why this question wouldn't necessarily be just way out from left field to be asking Jesus. Wouldn't be, except, can I go back to verse 20? They pretended to be righteous. This is not a question asked in righteous motives. It's not a question asked for any reason. This goes back to verse 19. They wanted to get Jesus. So they're watching him in verse 20. And they ask this question in verse 22. And guess what? Jesus knows plenty. So in verse 23, he knows their ulterior motives. But he detected their trickery, their cunning, just like the snake. Jesus sees through their real intentions or their question to the real intentions. The Gospel of Mark mentions, it says, Jesus knew their hypocrisy. Here, Luke has already called the authorities hypocritical. So he describes their intent is panurgia, a Greek word that means readiness to do anything, cunning, scheming. But why are these men asking this question? Why is this trickery? Why is this a trick question? Well, here's the thing. These men believe they can get Jesus to answer the question truthfully, because truthfully, if he answered the question, which we'll see Jesus do, but he does it in a way nobody expects, he would say, you know what? Well, we know from the New Testament that God has allowed governments to be in power, so he's in ultimate control anyway, right? So you can't get out of paying taxes. So if he answers truthfully, guess what? He's thinking this is going to cause, or they're thinking it's going to cause Jesus to lose favor with the crowd because he supports taxes by these foreigners. But if Jesus were to answer in favor of the crowd, which would be against the tax, then guess what? They got him where they want him. They got him going to Caesar. He's starting a rebellion. Don't pay the tax. Look at, he's the leader. And like I was saying, the tribute, and it's interesting, tribute and tax, why are those words used interchangeably? Because in a sense, it's a way to give it to the occupying king. In fact, it's almost considered like a way to pay homage. But honestly, it's also a way to make money. So Jesus knows their trickery. So he says, show me a denarius. So he answers the question by setting itself up with the money itself. Give me the money. Well, a denarius was the head tax. And then he asked that question, whose likeness and inscription does it have? So he asked to see this coin paid for the head tax, this denarius. And then here's the thing is, by asking them, that means, number one, they've got that coin. This foreigner's coin. Now think about it. If you go to the temple, you could not use the foreigner's coin. You had to go to the money changers, which there's a little exchange rate, you know, ATM fees and everything as they are, credit card fees. But they're going to make a little money off it, and then they're going to give you the money of Palestine, what Israel uses. But yet, the funny thing is, and it's real subtle, but give me that coin. So they, what's that saying? They use that coin. They use the coin. So that, number one, I think that's just worth pointing out. That, hey, you know, because some people would say, well, my objection to paying taxes is because you have to have the foreign currency that shows what it says, what the inscription is. And by the way, the inscription on the image of the coin is either, so Tiberius would have been the successor of Augustus. But like the inscription of the coin of Caesar Augustus would say, Tiberius Caesar Augustus, the son of the divine Augustus. So highlighting his divinity, if you will. Now, are we surprised there's Roman emperor worship? No, we're not. But so that would be one objection. Oh, we can't pay this tax because it's highlighting, you know, well, he just gave me a coin. You're evidently not that upset because you're what? You're making money exchanging in the marketplace with that coin. The second thing is, and by the way, if you're Pharisees, that would say, well, you're not so separate. But the second thing is that he's going to make a point, an object lesson with that very coin. And so then he gives this deeper answer. And he said, render to Caesar the things that are Caesar, send to God the things that are God. Now, I say this is a deeper answer because it really is. So when we say the word render, we should understand one thing. The word apodidomi, render, has to do with obligation. In one sense, it means to give back, to return. In another sense, reward. But in light of Jesus looking at the money, the meaning has to do with giving or paying back. Now, why would that have anything to do with anything? Because Jesus is making a point. So first of all, when he says rendering to Caesar, what is he really saying? Well, paying a tax involves paying back an obligation because you're part of the government. So on the one hand, if you derive benefits from the government, roads, policing, order, then you have an obligation to pay. On the other hand, the obligation which you're rendering to Caesar is limited to the money. It's all you got. It has nothing to do with devotion to Caesar. So in a sense, he is saying, yeah, pay your taxes. Pay the tax. But what does he mean, rendering to God? Well, what is the standard of obligation to God? Love the Lord your God with part of your heart, some of your mind, all. Love the Lord your God with your whole being. That's the standard, right? So by drawing a distinction between Caesar and God, the claims of Caesar on the coin are rejected. So he's not saying don't pay your taxes, but he's saying, you know, if you just give back the money that you're using in this currency as part of the tax, that's one thing. What are God's obligations? What did he always say when he was approached numerous times about the most important commandment? Just to love the Lord your God. So how do we view God in government, if you will? Well, governments have the right to exist. We're told to submit to their authority. And 1 Peter 2:13 through 17 says this: submit yourselves for the Lord's sake to every human institution, whether to a king as the one in authority or to governments as sent by him for the punishment of evildoers and the praise of those who do right. For such is the will of God, that by doing right you may silence the ignorance of foolish men. Act as free men. Do not use your freedom as a covering for evil, but use it as bondslaves of God. Honor all the people. Love the brotherhood. Fear God and honor the king. Now, it doesn't say honor God and fear the king. It's just the opposite. And fear has a much deeper meaning than honor. So they have a right to exist. And by the way, so when Jesus affirms, render to Caesar what is Caesar's, to God what is God, he is not, by the way, affirming to subvert God under the government, but that each have their place. God, by the way, has the ultimate claims of authority. When Jesus arrives, as the book of Revelation describes, he is called the King of what? All? I mean, that'd be supreme, right? He is supreme. He has the ultimate claims of authority over every government. We don't ever place God into a lesser role in our life. But on the other hand, it doesn't give an excuse to use, well, I don't like the government, so I'm not going to do these things. I mean, let me give you a stupid analogy just came to my mind. And I'm thinking here of John, in a sense, he doesn't work for the government, but he works for the university. And let's just say, well, I don't like the way the university does things. So let's just say, John doesn't either. I can sympathize with you students, but you got to submit to what I've got you to do if you're going to be part of this system. It doesn't mean, by the way, because I'm your teacher, that you're holding me in a greater position over God. And that's the point. That's the way you view it. But you follow through on things. And I think sometimes those things have been used as an excuse to just not want to obey the law. Well, those laws are stupid. You know what? There are lots of stupid laws. Really stupid ones. But here's the thing, when we say we don't subvert God under the government, if there's a law that tells us to break God's law, then that's the thing we would say, no, we can't. We have to subject ourselves to God. However, there's a number of laws that can be stupid that don't ask us to disobey God. They're just stupid. So speed limit, I'm sorry, you really don't have a moral justification to just say, well, I don't have to obey it if I feel like it. whether you get to church early or not, because you got up early enough or not, doesn't really matter whether you're going the speed limit or not. If you get pulled over, you can't say, well, God wants me here at 10:30. You can't say that, right? In fact, if the officer would probably say, you know what, that's why you get up at 8:30 then, or whatever. So you don't, you know, you don't use that as an excuse. However, this is the thing. The obligation is more important. Now, if I want to talk about giving to God compared to giving to Caesar, right? That's where, if we really want to take that one seriously, not as an excuse to not obey the government, then we have to take due. What does that mean to really give God what is due God? So have you thought about what does it really mean to fear the Lord? That is, to have reverence for Him. Do you think, what does reverence for God look in all aspects of your life? What is it? Now, it's interesting because we have this, it seems like it's not a trichotomy or whatever. That's not how we're divided, but it uses things like heart, soul, mind, strength to say, it's a way to say with your whole being. But we, you know, I don't, let's say I was at Ben's baseball game a few weeks back, and I don't tell people, well, my hand was at Ben's baseball game. I would say, I was at Ben's baseball game. I don't divide myself into parts. That's not how we think of ourselves. We are a whole being, a unified being. We were wholly there. But this is how we need to think. We cannot compartmentalize our Christian life to say, well, this part of my life is going to act and look like it's Christian, and the rest of them, whatever. This is gets us back to the hypocritical thing, right? If we want to be hypocritical, do all those things to the Lord. And that's why it's like, that's a beautiful answer, what He has just given. Because He's just raised the standard. He said, number one, you're trying to get me about this taxes. Really, the issue is, hey, Caesar just wants your taxes. But you're not compromising your real devotion and worship to God. That obligation is way higher than the government. And if it ever changes, as we look in the book of Revelation, then you know, obviously you're going to rebel against it. But what I love about this ending of this is the words of their opponents. Not only could they not catch Him, they were amazed at His answer, and they became silent, meaning they had nothing else to say. I phrase this is like, not only is it a truthful answer, it's a gentle answer. Gentle in the sense of it reaches so many different levels and deals with the subject, but deals with it in a way, you're not going to use Jesus' words against Him. Because what has He done? He's focused on just the government. He's made it into, really, what are you doing for God to render to God? What is God's? See, sometimes as Christians, well, what can we get away with and what can we do? We don't ask, what should we be doing for God? It's a minimalist thinking if we don't think that way. Well, what do we need to do? Tell me what I have to do. Pastor Steve, tell me what I have to do tonight or today from the pulpit. Ever hear those? Sometimes what God's got to say to us may be more than just one thing. He's dealing with areas of our life. What is it? So if I would, in closing, kind of just tell us what, kind of walk through this. So here's the thing is, there's no political party, when we think of God and government, that takes the place of God. And I think our problem is, and maybe some of us are learning, when we look to political parties, and I don't care which one, I can tell you the one that might be the least offensive. It's kind of the way it is lately, isn't it? They're not going to do what God can accomplish. So if you treat them like they're God, you're going to be in trouble. And I think for some folks, they have put all their hopes and dreams into political parties. and treat it as if their political party that they're voting for is going to just magically make all this disappear. God never asked you and told you that's going to happen. Don't give that the place of God. However, I'm going to say this just as true, very true. Don't ever turn around, though, because I've seen this happen, is they could claim, well, I'm spiritual, so I'm not going to be involved in things of the government. I'm sorry, that doesn't work. We're in a government. We can go out and vote. I truly believe one of the reasons the mayor race turns out the way it does is because not enough Christians go out and vote. It's ridiculous. If you really believe your convictions, I don't have to stand up here and tell you that. But I've heard enough Christians say, well, I don't get involved in those things. Well, you complain about those things, so you kind of are involved. You complain when the property taxes go up. You complain about this and that. And I'm not saying, by the way, they're not legitimate complaints. I don't think anybody really likes their taxes going up. But you can't turn around and say, I'm spiritual, so I can't. No, I mean, God's not telling you to give the devotion to Him by going out and voting. But that's part of what you get to do as a believer too. And praise God, we still are in a society we can vote and do these things. So, in light of that, though, in light of those two things being true, right? We look at the state of affairs. We could wring our hands. Oh, my goodness, I can't believe it. Instead of wasting all of our time doing that, use that energy, number one, and the one that we have to render the most to, and that's God. Pray. Have we figured out prayer is a powerful thing that God has enabled? It's not I don't even want to call it a tool because that cheapens it. Prayer is communication with the Almighty Creator of this universe, the sustainer of this universe, who works in individuals' lives. And dare I say, even if they want Him to be involved or not, He works. So why don't we pray? Why don't we use more energy focusing on that to pray? And I know some of you do, so this is hopefully affirmation. Some of you maybe need to, instead of wringing your hands and getting so upset watching the news, which can happen, just turn it off and pray. Secondly, and this is important, take serious the charge to give God the things of God's. So if I were to ask you, what is the areas or parts of your life that you really haven't rendered to? I can't answer that for you, but God will. You pray that. God, show me areas that I need to get over to You. He'll do that for you. And then if you're looking for affirmation, don't expect it from the headlines, right? However, God has given you His Word that can give you more affirmation than anything else. I mean, it's one of the things I would say after becoming a believer that I found time and time again to be true from the time I was, you know, being discipled by a fellow believer, Dean Hatfield, to getting involved in the Navigators, and they're very strong in their Word ministry. I saw the value of the Word and how it was working in me and changing me and helping me. Let that permeate you more than anything else. But again, what we see here is even in the midst of trickery, Jesus uses an opportunity to really challenge. And to me, the cool thing is His enemies literally like, that's a good answer. I can't say anything to it. Like, yeah, He's right on. So, by the way, the Herodians couldn't say, oh, see, he didn't say not to pay anything. And then, but yet those, the Pharisees who separate would be able to say, well, give the things to God. Yeah, we can get on board with that. Now, they didn't like His answer, but they couldn't say anything. They were amazed. I wouldn't expect any less from Jesus, though.